Hi.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Joel Whitaker, the editor of Cane's Beverage News Daily, and we're delighted to have with us today John McDonald, who has just been named chairman of the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, which we all affectionately call DISCUS. And he's the chief operating officer at Patron Spirits, which has been setting the world on fire. So we want to talk to John about both topics today. And hi, John. How are you? And congratulations.
Good morning. Thanks very much.
Good. So, John, let's start with DISCUS and the challenges facing the distilled spirits industry in general. What sort of challenges do you see the industry in general facing, and how do you see DISCUS being able to help solve those?
Well, there's two major issues that I feel are facing DISCUS. The first one is the impending threats of increased taxation on the beverage alcohol industry, and secondly, continuing to be socially responsible. So how we're going to deal with the tax threats are, we just got to continue to, you know, work closely with our wholesalers to fight off any federal excise tax threats or state tax threats. You know, with the, as you know, the U.S. economy is struggling, and where our debt is increasing daily or by the minute, and they're looking for revenue generation. So they're going to look at distilled spirits, and, you know, if they take the cost of living increases since the last time there was a tax threat, which was tax increase, which was 1981, we could be looking at a close to 60% increase in the federal excise tax. And what we need our legislators to understand is the last time we took a federal excise tax, it took 10 years to collect the same amount of money as we were collecting in 1991, which was before they took the federal excise tax. So it doesn't generate more money because people start trading down to beer when they take the federal excise taxes up. The second point I made was about social responsibility, and we have to just stay true to our DISCUS advertising code. And we, all the member companies do a great job in that, and we have to be careful about the advertising we do on the social media, make sure that we have age gating in place, and we don't do anything that would invite your advocacy groups to attack us.
Sure, that makes perfect sense. You know, talking about the tax increase possibility, I did not realize it had been 30 years since that last increase, but...
20.
20, I'm sorry, I can't add.
That's okay.
Now you know why you're operating officer and I'm an editor.
No issue.
But, you know, I remember covering that, and, you know, it was a very tense time before it got passed, and then it was, as you say, there was a significant drop in tax revenue. They took it up far too much and far too fast and ended up losing, which is often what happens when the legislators do tax increases. So we certainly hope that you guys are successful in fighting off any challenges that you may have there. And I know it's going to be a very, very busy time because as the spending binge continues, the pressure is just going to start growing for getting money from any place that they can find it. You know, it's just the way of the world. So those are the two challenges, and that's basically how you're going to have to deal with them. One is the traditional lobbying and working with your wholesalers very intently, and of course they have a tremendous interest in not seeing tax increases on spirits, because if sales go down, their revenue goes down, and it's a mathematical certainty for that. And secondly, the social responsibility thing, where the spirits industry has been by and large extremely good. I remember being told back in the very early 80s, John, that the spirits industry was the most responsible of the alcohol beverage industries. So I was told that by an official at what is now TTB. So you've managed to sustain that, and I know you guys will continue to do that in the future. Let's talk about Patron, where the company is today, where you want to take it, and how you plan to get there. And what I'm going to do, John, is I'm going to sort of shut up and not ask you a series of questions unless you want me to, and just let you tell me your story.
Well, the most important thing that I want to impress upon the readers and the listeners is that one of the key successes when you move past the quality of the product and that it's handmade and we use the finest raw materials, et cetera, is that we have stayed true to our strategic plan, which is no matter how challenging things had become in the economy, we would not cut back on marketing and activities to support the brand. And while many of our competitors slashed marketing and laid off people, we've done just the opposite. We've increased our marketing, we've added people, and we continue to grow the brand despite these economic challenges. So Patron has grown every year during the last 5 years despite the economic downturn. So we're going to continue to do that. And one example that I've used in the past that I think is appropriate for this conversation is when you look at two cereal companies. One was Kellogg's and one was Post. And during the Great Depression, they took two very different approaches. Post said that they were going to cut back their marketing budget, they were going to cut back on people and take all of it to the bottom line so that they could meet their shareholders' expectations. Kellogg said, no, we're going to take this opportunity to increase our marketing and support the brands because when the things turn around, we'll be that much stronger. So I ask you, which cereal company do you hear about the most today?
Exactly, and it's Kellogg's, of course.
Right. So, in fact, and you know, as you have seen in the news, I'm sure the last 2 weeks they're on an acquisition. They just bought Pringles and they continue to grow. And we've studied every recessionary period since the Great Depression, and that's proven true with all companies. And Nielsen supports that fact. They said companies that support their brands will grow at a rate 275% faster than companies that don't support their brands in an economic downturn. And that percentage is over a five-year period that they say the growth will come.
That's just a stunning figure. You would think that, you know, that every company would be out there trying to support its brand during a downturn with a number like that. I wonder why they don't.
Well, there's one key difference between Patron and most of the other beverage alcohol companies is we're a private company, so we're building for the long term, and some of the other companies are public, and they have to satisfy their short-term shareholder profitability requests.
Right. And I suspect you enjoy being a private company, too, that being one thing and the other being freedom to act when you think you need to act.
Absolutely, and our CFO loves the fact that we're private, so he's not dealing with all these reportings.
Boy, I bet he does. Especially after that new law they passed a couple of years ago, I bet he really enjoys being private.
Yeah, absolutely. But the other thing that people often ask us is, you know, how far do we think we can grow the ultra-premium tequila category? And I always answer the question this way. There's 49 million ultra-premium white spirit drinkers in the United States, and Patron currently has 14 of the 49 that identify themselves as Patron consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So we still have over three times the opportunity to grow this brand with ultra-premium white consumers.
Great. So you have a lot of opportunity ahead of you, which I guess means that you will continue focusing just on what you have now, correct? Or am I wrong about that?
Well, we're going to focus on our current portfolio. I've made a mistake in the past of identifying categories we would like to get into,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm inundated with requests to buy this brand and that brand, so I stay away from talking about brands or categories we'd like to have. But what I can tell you is this, we're going to continue to expand, you know, in the tequila category, and we'll go up market. And the second thing is we've just launched our first extension of our coffee liqueur. It's Patron Exo Cafe Mocha. So hopefully that's going to take, you know, our coffee liqueur brand to the next level, because we're hopeful within 5 years to grow that to be our second million case brand in the world.
That would be very good. That would be quite nice for you guys. And I presume in doing that you're just repeating the process you used for your current products?
Yes, we use what's different about our coffee liqueur and the coffee mocha is that We don't use grain neutral spirits of the base or molasses like a lot of the other coffee liqueur brands do. We use Patron Tequila Silver as the base. And by doing that, it cuts the sweetness of the products. So ours is less sweet than the competitors on the market, because when you put molasses on top of it, it's, you know, it's very sugary.
Sure. Well, that's very good. When you go into in launching this, would you walk me through how you do it? I mean, do you start with the usual bar and on premise trade, or do you do an advertising blitz in a particular market, or how do you introduce a product?
Well, the way this brand, our entire company's been built, is we focus in the on premise sector, mm-hmm. and you know, most brands in the United States would be 70% off-premise and 30% on.
Mm-hmm.
Our portfolio is about 50-50, so it's equally split. And as I'm sure you've heard before, another company say the same thing, your brands are built on-premise.
Sure.
So we put all our time and effort focused at the on-premise sector. And we'll start with trade advertising only. And once we gain the distribution and get some traction, then we'll launch with above-the-line activities. But right now, everything's done below the line with special events, tastings. You know, we have cakes that we also use for tastings, so we can. That's the path we go down when introducing a new product.
Good. And it's obviously worked very well. You've got 1 million cases in one, and you're looking for your second, so good luck on that. Are you set on your distribution? Do you have enough distributors, and are you happy with the work they're doing?
In the U.S., you know, we're set on our distributors. The key challenges for us is, you know, our international expansion.
Mm-hmm.
5.5 years ago, we were only in 2 countries outside the U.S., and now we're in 130 countries outside the United States. And one of the challenges we face is, you know, we look for our distributors that have an ultra-premium mindset, because when you're selling outside the U.S., it's bottle by bottle, and finding those type of wholesalers can be challenging, especially since we're a relatively small player outside the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So I can say, you know, 90% of the time we've made the right decision, but there's a 10% where we're always looking to improve upon our distribution partners outside the U.S.
Sure. Why would it be bottle by bottle outside the U.S.? I haven't heard that before, and, you know, I totally believe you, but I just wonder why you can't just sell cases outside the U.S. like you can in the U.S.
Well, the reason I say that is because 88% of tequila is consumed in Mexico and the United States.
Okay.
So when you take the other, you know, Diageo, I believe, has stated they're in 180 countries.
Mm-hmm.
So if you use that number as a base, those 180 countries only account for 12% of the rest of the world tequila consumption. And when you put Germany in the mix, they're one of the top 5 tequila markets in the world, and it's all inexpensive tequila that they sell. So when you look at the pool Patron's competing in outside the United States, it's extremely small. So that's why we're on a mission to educate the rest of the world on ultra-premium tequilas. So it's people tend to buy bottles versus cases when they're trying something new.
I totally understand the picture now, and yes, you will have to do a big education job in order to turn that around. I'm also stunned to hear that Germany is a very large tequila company country. It's not the sort of country I would think of as the natural place to sell tequila.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But it is what it is, and in this case, that's a good phrase. My sister once said that when you say it is what it is, that usually means something very bad is happening. But in this case, it's a good thing. So I hope you'll let me use it once in a while here. So that's great. How about your staffing? Are you staffed up to where you need to be? Are you going to be looking to hire some people? And if so, what sort of people are you looking for?
Well, right now we're increasing our staff both internationally and within the United States. We're just hiring some sales analyst, you know, by region in the United States, because, you know, our business has grown and it warrants that type of position now. And outside the U.S., We're continuing to add bodies. We just hired somebody for Northern Asia. We're going to hire somebody for Western Europe and somebody additional for the Caribbean. So, which is great because as our business grows, we need to, you know, support the organization with additional bodies.
Sure. These people you're hiring for the outside the U.S. component, are they salespeople or are they analytical people, or tell me what you're looking for a little bit more.
No, in outside the U.S., we're hiring salespeople that have skill sets that include managing wholesalers and understanding how to execute below the line activities. So that's the focus outside.
Okay, and I presume that necessarily means that if you're hiring for, to say, Germany, you're going to want to hire a German versus hire somebody in the U.S. and send them over there.
We're not opposed to taking somebody from the U.S. and transferring them, but they would have to have the skill sets that warrant that move. So most likely it'll be somebody from that region of the world.
Right.
And we're also, when you're dealing with Europe, as you know, there's so many countries, you know, being a multilingualist is key.
Sure. And that's not something you find readily in the United States among a large number of people anyway.
Unfortunately, I agree with you.
Exactly. How about your physical capacity? Are you going to have to add any distilling capacity or anything like that, or are you all set in that area?
Well, that's a good question. I'm very glad you asked that. One of the knocks that people take at Patron is that, since we've gotten bigger, we've become mass-produced, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. What we've done is we've replicated our initial distillery about 12 times. It just happens to be under the same roof.
Mm-hmm.
So we make the same amount of ovens, pot stills, et cetera, and everything we do continues to be in small batches, and everything about Patron is done by hand. The only thing we use machinery for is to put the liquid in the bottle, and that's because of government regulations. Everything else is done by hand. The glass, the labeling, the cork, the strip stamps, everything. So that's part of what's made us so special, and we never want to get away from that.
That is quite an accomplishment. Usually that's correct. I mean, people, when they start to grow, they start to automate, and yet you've resisted that all the way down the line.
And we will continue to do so. That's part of our mission.
I can see your ads when you start doing print ads. You can be like Jack Daniels and show people, you know, individually standing there putting the label on or whatever, or stoking the oven, and you'd have a great advertising campaign with that. Be the Jack Daniels of the tequila business.
That's a very good point. In fact, if you have an opportunity to go to our website, we take you through the entire process that shows exactly what you just articulated. Everything by hand, stoking the ovens, you know, right until the product goes into the shipper.
Sure. That's fabulous. Are you, let's talk a little bit about you, John, unless I've missed something on the Patron business, where it is today and where you want to take it, and I think we've covered that, but if I'm wrong, tell me. But let's talk a little bit about you. Where do you come from? How did you get involved in the industry? How did you end up with Patron? That sort of thing.
Okay, well, after I graduated university in Boston, Massachusetts, where I grew up, I noticed that I owed a lot of people a lot of money. I was in debt, and I figured that I needed to eat, so I begged somebody to get me a job, and I ended up starting in the research department at Joseph E. Seagram & Sons. And then I was fortunate to spend 18 great years with Seagram and one bad year, and the bad year was the last year when the company was sold,
right?
You know, because we were just all the uncertainty that goes along with the sale of a company. And it was protracted sale. You know, I think it took a year and a half when it should have taken 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, Seagram gave me the training, the experience to start my own company. In fact, I was fortunate with Seagram. I became an international employee. I was fortunate to live in Taiwan, the UK, and Italy. So I got the experience of different cultures and different parts of the world. And because of that experience, I was able to start my own sales and marketing consulting company with another gentleman, Mike Roberts, and we called it the Action Group. And people said, why do you call it the Inaction Group? And the reason was because most people are in action, and we like to take action. Mm-hmm. So that's why we came up with that name. And Patron was our first client.
Uh-huh.
And then they were happy with the work we've done, and then the CEO asked me to come on in January of 2005. And, you know, that's when we sat down and said, we're gonna take this to the next level. And we came up with we hired an advertising agency. We plowed a lot of money into the infrastructure. And also at that time, we decided we'd go internationally. So now we're in over 700 airports globally, and as I mentioned before, 130 countries. And we went from about 100,000+ case business to about 2.3 million cases total company worldwide now.
That's very impressive. And it sounds like all of your experiences really led you to where you are today, including your time there with the consultancy and then your client wanting you to come on board and the whole thing, your international experience. It sounds like it's all worked very well for you.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate. And again, you know, Seagram gave me the foundation to be able to do what I'm doing today. If I hadn't had that international experience, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, assume the role I have now.
Sure. And it sounds like you're the guy who sort of is driving the international side of the business now.
Well, I mean, I'm just one guy of many talented people at Patron. I will say that most of the people that we work with are ex-Seagram people, mm-hmm. and, you know, we all knew what didn't work at Seagram, so we've all joined together, and we don't waste a lot of time, and we make things happen. So, you know, I don't want to – yes, we're building international, but, you know, a lot of my focus is on the U.S. because that's where, you know, drives the profit and the volume.
That's where the business is, yeah.
Yes. But it's important to be global also because you don't want a U.S. consumer going to Madrid and not being able to find Patron if that's what they like to drink because you don't want them trying something else and losing them.
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting to hear you say that many of your coworkers are Seagram alumni. I thought that was just an extremely classy company when in its heyday there, and I was so sorry when they ended up selling it, but those things happen, I guess. But it, you know, it certainly trained the industry. You know, a lot of the guys at Diageo are Seagram people, at Pernod, you know, just across the board. So it's a good place to have been.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there was about 10,000 other people that were sad like you when it went away.
Yeah. And, you know, I never worked there, but I thought it was just an extremely well-run company. So, John, tell me this. Have we covered all the things you think we should cover, or is there something you wish I had asked you?
No, the one thing that I do wish you had asked me is that we're very conscientious about the environment. And, you know, when 1 gallon of Patron generates 18 gallons of liquid waste, mm-hmm. and we've invested over $10 million in Mexico to take all the byproducts of the production of Patron and turn it into reusable water or fertilizer for the fields. So the Mexican version of the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, has said that Patron's the leader in the tequila region for, you know, taking waste and reusing it. So we're extremely proud of that work that we've done down there.
Well, that's a fabulous thing to have done in Mexico, and it's a great thing for the industry as a whole and, you know, helps provide a standard for others to meet. So congratulations on that. You know, speaking about Mexico, has your... have your workers and all been relatively safe? Because all I hear on the TV news is these continuing battles going on in Mexico, and I have to wonder about how easy or how difficult it is to do business there at the moment.
No, I mean, like, you know, like any place, you always take the precautions that you need to make sure everybody's safe. So we've ramped up our you know, security to make sure everybody's taken care of. So fortunately, nothing has happened.
Well, we hope
that would be of concern to anyone.
We hope that remains the case. We do not want to be reporting bad news about Patron at any time in the future. So that would be good if things continue the way they are today for you.
Well, we appreciate that.
Well, great, John. So anything else we should have covered here?
No, I think we've covered quite a lot of ground, and I appreciate you taking the time to chat me up.
I appreciate the time to interview you, and if you will stand by for a minute, I'm going to wrap this and end the recording, and then we will. I want to just get a couple of minor details
to make
sure that I can do what I need to do. So thank you so much for being with us today, and hopefully our listeners have gotten something out of this interview, which I find quite instructive and quite beneficial. And, you know, have a great day, and we'll see you all again soon. Bye-bye.